I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's good to see Jason Kander out and about these days. His sudden withdrawal from Kansas City's latest mayoral race and public life to get treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder caught so many of us by surprise. Kander's re-entry into the community created buzz, too. He was part of a group that escorted presidential candidate and fellow Afghanistan veteran Pete Buttigieg on a tour of the Veterans Community Project. Today, Jason and his wife Diana take us through the years leading up to his PTSD diagnosis. We'll ask how that time affected them individually, as a couple, and as a family. Then we'll talk about the future. Is a return to the political track a possibility? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Jason Kander is on the comeback trail, the man who passed on the 2020 race for the presidency, then entered and exited the 2019 race for Kansas City mayor, is reemerging from a self-imposed exile that followed his announcement that he was suffering from PTSD stemming from his military service in Afghanistan. His focus these days is on the Veterans Community Project aimed at helping vets with housing and other needs. Now 38, he says he feels better today than he's felt in a very long time. Joining him today is his wife, Diana. The two have written an article to be published next week detailing their joint struggle with post-traumatic stress, with Diana's struggles connected to her husband's. Jason Kander is a former Missouri Secretary of State and a state representative from Kansas City. If circumstances had been different, he might have been the city's new mayor today. Jason, nice to see you again. Welcome.
Always good
nice
to be
to
here.
Have you. Diana Kander is a lawyer, an innovation coach, public speaker, and podcaster of a series she calls Professional AF. Her latest book is The Curiosity Muscle, How Four Simple Questions Can Uncover Powerful Insights and Exponential Growth. It's co-written with Andy Fromm. And today is their anniversary, so there's no better way to spend it, right, Diana?
That's right. I believe the 16-year wedding anniversary is the go on radio and talk about your mental health struggles anniversary.
There you go. And here we are.
I got to find a card for that.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard.
So, Jason, I guess the question, and I bet you get asked this a lot these days, is, you know, how are you?
I do get asked that a lot.
I bet you do.
And I'm doing fantastic. I'm, as you said, I'm doing the best I've done in about 12 years, you know, since I came home. And one of the reasons that I am speaking publicly about this now after waiting, you know, 9 or 10 months is I just want people to see that post-traumatic growth is a real thing and it's worth trying to achieve.
Diana, how are you?
I mean, it's been an incredible 8 months since the October announcement.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we have a renewed marriage, renewed family. It's incredible.
You know, people may be confused about your own connection to the trauma here, Diana. And again, you write about that in the article you're going to publish next week. Tell us about that.
Sure. So one of the main points of the article is most people might not understand that they have PTSD. We didn't understand it. We came up with all kinds of explanations about the symptoms. But
and again, you're saying we.
Yeah.
You
and,
both suffered from it.
Yeah, and even fewer people know about secondary PTSD,
right,
which is if you live with somebody or you're around post-traumatic stress symptoms long enough, and for me it was for 12 years, you can start developing some of the same symptoms as that person. So one of the symptoms Jason and I share in common is hypervigilance, which is an over-concerned sense of danger and need for control. And, you know, his stemmed from he was having a lot of nightmares about terrible things every single night. But then he would wake me up and tell me the nightmares every night. So even though I wasn't experiencing them, I was really living them. And we would just constantly be having conversations in our house about all the dangers that existed around. And, you know, you get enough of that kind of dripping and,
right,
and you start developing similar symptoms. I thought what I had was anxiety. You know, you come up with different names to explain away right. what's going on. And it wasn't until Jason started going to therapy that his therapist was like, oh, pretty textbook, secondary PTSD. And I went to see a trauma therapist. And she was like, oh, yeah, pretty clear.
Tell us about that moment. Because when you did learn there was such a thing as secondary PTSD, it really hit you hard.
Yeah, it wasn't until it wasn't even those moments when they said, yeah, that's probably what it is. I read an article about secondary PTSD, which described a military spouse. The article started with this wife who was doing the laundry, and she started having like a lot of fears about somebody being in the house. And, you know, they described hypervigilance, and then they said, you know, she's never served. Her husband served. And I just started crying. You know, like it just seemed very real for me. And then as soon as I learned about it, I was like, people need to know that this is a thing.
Jason and Diana Kander are my guests. You know, Jason, one of your struggles, I thought this was so interesting, was coming to this understanding that you were suffering from post-traumatic stress. Because when you were in Afghanistan, you didn't engage in direct combat. And so you thought all along, it couldn't be me, it couldn't be post-traumatic stress, because you were in a different category somehow.
It took me a long time to realize that there's a lot of ways to define combat.
Yeah.
You know, my role in Afghanistan as an intelligence officer was to go out and be basically alone, just myself and a translator, meet with people who were often unsavory characters, not knowing whether or not, frankly, I was going to come out of that room alive. And so for me, it wasn't, it was not so often the case that my biggest worry was getting into a firefight. It was getting kidnapped and then, you know, killed.
Mm-hmm.
And so because, you know, I had a more traditional notion of what combat was, I would look at my friends who were experiencing post-traumatic stress who had been in firefights, for instance, and I'd think, well,
those guys deserve it.
They earned it.
Yeah, right.
Who am I to claim the same injury as them? But then I would have conversations with them. I mean, it was right there in front of me. I should have seen it, because I would have conversations with them, you know, trading literal war stories. And they would say, man, I never could have done what you did. And I'd say, well, I'm really glad I didn't have to do what you did. And then only when I was really in my first real therapy session at the VA with a clinical social worker that I described all this. And she said to me, she said, you know, your friends who were in firefights, they were among their friends at the time. They were with their fellow members of their unit. It would last for a few minutes at a time, and then it would be over. And she said, you were out there by yourself, essentially, vulnerable for hours at a time. She said, did anybody know where you were? I said, no. She said, so you had no backup. And the way then to hear another person describe it, I realized, oh, that's actually pretty traumatic. And then she made the point to me. She said, because I had said, look, I just thought I was a jerk who went to meetings, right? And she said, yeah, but you went to meetings in the most dangerous place in the world with people who might want to kill you. And she said, and then your friends didn't come home and get in firefights, but you came home and went to meetings and in my job. And it took that realization that, you know, trauma is trauma. In the military, they teach you necessarily that somebody is always, there's always somebody who's done something harder than you, and there's always somebody who's got it worse than you right now. And that's a really important training aspect, because if they didn't train that into me, I may not have been able to go into those rooms. If they didn't train that into other soldiers, then they may not be able to go on the next patrol. Well, the thing is, they don't turn that off. So when you come home, it takes a lot of work to get to the point where you don't feel like, look, somebody has it worse than me. A good buddy of mine, who's kind of my mentor of going through the process of going to the VA, said to me once, and he had seen a lot of firefights and that sort of thing. And he said, man, somewhere there's a World War II veteran in a VFW hall saying, look, I was in the back of the landing craft at D-Day. Those guys in the front are the ones who really had it tough.
Right, right. So, Diana, what was the moment then when you both came to realize there was a name for what you were dealing with?
I think this is Jason's part of the story, because his depression had been getting worse and worse. Like, the mayoral race was going really well, and the better it went, the more down he became. And we had a conversation about his suicidal ideation, and it got really scary. And it was right before the announcement that he called the suicide hotline for the VA for the first time. And it was like a very pedantic conversation. It was like a very boring conversation from their end. Like it was a totally normal thing that they heard. And then he got off the phone and we Googled PTSD. And that sounds so silly.
Yeah, because it was like, for me, I had been telling myself for so long, well, look, there's just something wrong with me. It's not, it's, you know, I'm just defective. This is just how I am. And because I couldn't accept the idea that what I had been through was enough to be a real injury.
Right.
And so when I called and I heard the woman's voice on the other end of the phone sound very casual, just casual. And I don't mean casual in a negative sense. I mean, like, this was not a unique phone call to her. Mm-hmm. I sounded the same as everybody else who'd called that day. And that was kind of a wake up. And then it kind of proceeded from there. And then, you know, the moment when I realized, wow, I got hurt over there, that, you know, that was very emotional for me.
And then you quickly realized what, you had to discontinue your run for mayor?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, I don't even remember making the decision. It was over the next 24 hours. It was just like, okay. And then really the only decision was, are we going to talk about why? And that was a pretty easy decision too, because I felt like, you know, if somebody had talked about this and experienced what I had experienced and done so publicly in the last 12 years, maybe I would have sought help a lot sooner. So I just thought, well, that's what I'm going to do. And also, being a public person, I felt like I had been hiding this from myself and from the rest of the world for so long, and I was just exhausted of it. And so for me, it was also just sort of about, you know what, I'm not going to stop being a public person. I'm going to, as I walk around Kansas City, folks recognize me. I would rather not have to put on a face. So it was both of those things that caused me to just be public about it.
You know, Diana, what strikes me is so amazing about your story and about human beings in general is that, you know, I covered Jason at the first debate, you know, for mayor, and, you know, I've known him for a number of years now, and, you know, I didn't recognize anything amiss. It's amazing to me the ability of human beings to mask so much of what they're dealing with every day. You're his wife. I mean, did you notice some of the same things too?
I mean, I knew because I was the only person that Jason was talking to about everything. But
which might have a little to do with her developing secondary PTS, by the way.
But imagine telling his parents, who were hearing about his suicidal thoughts and depression for the first time that weekend.
I told them before I put it in the paper. but it was a hard conversation.
My parents, his parents, nobody knew.
Well, nobody knew, and yet there were people close to us who were like, okay, that, like, you're very close to us. You know, my family, her family.
Like, everybody had seen signs that they're like, oh, you know, those make sense. And there were several of the folks that were really close to me and Jason on the campaign who had spent a lot of time around him.
For years.
That felt like, you know, I saw a lot of signs, and I wish I would have done something else, but we didn't really know what to do, because it's hard, even when you see something, even now when we see the signs in other people that we interact with, like, what can you do?
And I told everybody who said that to me, I was like, well, there's nothing you could have done, because I wasn't ready to hear that anyway. So you could have said, it wouldn't have mattered. Because I was not admitting it to myself.
Yeah.
So how am I going to hear it from you? And also, a lot of those people, even though we've known them for years, they've only known me post-deployment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Jason sits facing the door. Jason doesn't sleep well because he has nightmares. Jason doesn't like it when people sit behind him in a meeting. That's how Jason is. And that, and if that's the only version of me you've known, and after a while, that was the only version of me I knew. It had been a long time.
But your point is, you can't hear that message that you might have an issue unless you're willing, willing to acknowledge it to yourself.
Yeah, and Steve, what's really, on top of that, what's so incredible is I had counseled, and I don't mean in like the clinical sense, just in the social sense, a lot of my fellow veterans who, you know, I'm out there, I meet a ton of people, right? And I had a lot of veterans who would come up to me and like privately express some of what they were going through. And I was very capable of telling them, you need to go to the VA and get help, and there's nothing weak about it. And yet I couldn't give myself that same advice.
You know, just to give our listeners a sense of how tough it was, you've said in the wake of this that you're sleeping again. You've mentioned mm-hmm. sleep for the first time in a long, long time, a bunch of years. And at the height of this, if I remember correctly, you would actually get up, go outside, and you were marching around the house to make sure there were no intruders lingering in the bushes outside your home.
Yeah, man, I was on patrol. Like, and so what would happen is I'd have these violent nightmares, which also frequently included this thing called sleep paralysis, which I won't get into, but if you're curious at home, you can Google it, and it's it's not much fun.
Right.
And so that would be a part of my symptoms, is, you know, night terrors with sleep paralysis. And then I'd awake in the middle of the night, and I didn't want to go back to sleep because I'd go right back into this violent hellscape that was my subconscious. And what happened over time, and I thought that I was getting better because over time, the environment, like the venue, the setting for the dreams was less and less often Afghanistan. But it was more and more often my home, and it involved not necessarily violence against me all the time, but against my wife or my son.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like I, you know, and that, and being a public person, so being able to tell myself a story about there are, you know, there are dangers out there. So yeah, I'd be up, I'd check every room in the house, and I thought, okay, now I must be able to go back to sleep. And only in therapy, you know, in the last several months, did somebody finally explain to me, like, yeah, you're going into combat mode, your adrenaline's going all the way up, you're not going to go back to sleep. And so that's the sort of thing that I had to work through, and I had to learn that actually the environment changing in the dreams was not a measure of me getting better. It was a measure of me getting worse. It was the post-traumatic stress was evolving and making me feel like the danger was all around me. If the venue had continued to be Afghanistan in my dreams, it's a little easier to go back to sleep because you're like, okay, I'm not in Afghanistan. But
right.
Instead, you spend your whole day with all these visions overnight that you're remembering of these bad things happening.
Dinah, that's your husband talking. You were living right there for a long time. It's hard to hear.
No, I mean, I was going through a very similar thing, so it was like, seems really rational to me. You know, as we think about, you know, it's a very physiological response. It's not just happening in your brain, it's happening in your body. And when your adrenaline and your cortisol are spiking all the time, your body begins to fatigue out of it. And we were two very high-functioning cortisol spikers.
Yeah, right.
You know, but it was becoming really, really difficult.
That made it tougher for you, I'm just imagining here, because both of you are type A's. I mean, you're ambitious, you're driven, you're doing stuff. And getting off that train, stopping that train, has to have been really difficult.
It was really difficult at the time, but it, you know, was the best thing for us both personally and professionally. So when Jason made his announcement, I started saying no to any professional request unless it was the absolute best thing, like really valuable that I wanted to do. And it sounds really weird because I started saying no to like 90% of things
mm-hmm.
and people understood.
Mm-hmm.
My business has never been better than this because I said no to all the things that weren't good enough, mm-hmm. except for the very best opportunities. Those then turned into bigger and bigger opportunities.
The hard part for me was not going, pardon the term, but going at combat speed, like, because that's what I was used to. So like, I can remember one of my first appointments with the therapist I've had for the whole time at the VA. I said to him, you know, I've taken a big step back from work. I can be in here every day. And he goes, yeah, we're going to slow you down. he said, you're going to do weekly therapy and I'm going to give you homework during the week because part of your, you know, your avoidance strategy is you work on something all the time and it's how you don't have to deal with your stuff. He said, so we're going to make you just live in this for a while. And
that's a description that could apply to a whole lot of people, mm-hmm. including many of us who have never served in the military before.
Sure. I mean, there's people walking around with trauma all over the place, and we all find a different way, you know, some healthy, some not healthy, to avoid it. And for me, you know, it was, I just threw myself into work. And I also believed that, you know, prior to my announcement, I just believed, like, I mean, frankly, I was like, I'm trying to save the world here. What time do I have to deal with my own stuff? That'd be selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And And so it was learning how to, I mean, it was also just some practical stuff for me, like handling my own email, you know, mm-hmm. And that kind of thing. But it was just taking a step back. But it was wonderful for me because, you know, for the last 10 months, I have dropped off and picked up my son at school almost every day. I'm coaching his baseball team. I'm doing stuff that I never thought I was going to have the chance to do.
Yeah.
And now the work I'm doing with Veterans Community Project, now I'm taking something that I really care about and I'm adding that into the mix. And for the first time, like in a long, long time, I have a routine that I'm very wedded to and I really like, and it gives me the opportunity to just sort of get really healthy, and that's what I've done.
Well, it's an amazing story. Let's do this. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the reaction that Jason and Diana have received to their public announcement of suffering from post-traumatic stress. We'll talk about therapy. We'll talk about the future of politics and Jason's role in it. And we'll take your questions, too, at 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCURUpToDate. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. I'm on the radio, on social media, and now I can be in your inbox. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe to my weekly newsletter. Jason and Diana are going to do it in just a minute here. It includes words by yours truly and arrives every Monday. It's easy to sign up for and fast. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. Monday in the show, financial strategies for making your plans for retirement housing a reality. Whether you're budgeting for a beach house, an urban apartment, or maybe just a smaller place down the road, join me and the smart money experts for some strategies to make that happen. This hour, we're spending it with Jason and Diana Kander. We're talking about their struggles with post-traumatic stress, Afghanistan, politics, reactions to their announcements about their struggles, and the therapy they've gone through. Diana, what has been the reaction to your very public announcement of what the two of you have been through in the last few years?
I can't tell you how we received thousands of letters after Jason's announcement of people sharing their own personal struggles.
I bet.
And what was the most incredible thing is how many of those people were people we already knew and we knew well. You know, we talked about how hard it is to know people that we know so well, that we spend a lot of time with. We're like, oh, I attempted suicide. My wife attempted it twice. And these are just conversations that you never have with good friends.
Yes.
And so number one, I can't tell you like how many people confess struggling with some kind of mental health issue, enough to where I can walk into a restaurant and comfortably guess that half of the people in that room have some kind of mental struggle.
Just amazing.
Just from the people that we knew that said something. And the second thing is that everyone carries shame around it and they don't feel like they deserve it or they've earned it or that it's anything like our. It's so funny. Jason doesn't feel like his is as much as other people in the military. I don't feel like I was even in the military. Everybody's got a reason why they don't deserve it. And when you can let go of that and just say, I'm going to deal with what is, that's when you can finally start to get better.
But Jason, do you think this is changing? This notion that so many of us have suffered with some variation of a mental health illness or struggle, you get the sense that society's coming around in a fairly rapid way to a different place on this whole thing.
I mean, I think so. I really hope so. I had no idea what the reaction was going to be when I did this. I kind of got to a point where I didn't care, you know, which is probably why I was able to do this.
Because politicians don't do this very often, Jason.
Which is why I hadn't. You know, I've been very open about the fact that I just thought it would be very bad for my political career to say, I mean, heck, you know, I was thinking about running to be the commander in chief, and I thought it might be detrimental politically to say, like, I'm going to be the first suicidal president.
Yeah.
Like,
you think.
That's not a glass ceiling everybody's looking to shatter.
Right.
But once I things got bad enough, I was like, okay, this is just what I have to do. Then I was I actually took about 3 days where I said, I don't want to see any of the news, because I just kind of wanted to power down and focus on what I needed to do. But there was, I think maybe 2 mornings after the announcement, I remember I woke up, and to preface this, if you go back 12 years, when I was getting ready to deploy, folks in my family, my friend group, everybody would ask me, you know, why are you going to volunteer to do this? And I would always say the same thing, and it's what I truly felt, which was, you know, regardless of what you think about the war, if I do my job well, maybe some more service members come home safely. And I never felt at all like I achieved that. And the honest truth is probably most folks don't. Mm-hmm. But that was something I dealt with, and it was hard for me. And then a couple mornings after my announcement, I woke up and Diana was reading me very little of the news because I had asked not to see it. Not because I was afraid of it, just because, like, I was trying to deal with my stuff without thinking about how it was playing. Right. I'd done that for many years.
Right.
But what she told me was, she said that she had read that calls to the VA helpline had, like, tripled or something in the days since. And I got really emotional about that. And I remember saying, and I still feel, that was the first time I ever felt like I actually played a role in helping some people come home safely.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the interesting things about being public about your challenges is it sort of puts the world on notice that you're a safe place to talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
And that, as Diana said, that exposes to you, pulls back the curtain to you, that everybody's struggling with this stuff. And the thing is, you don't have to be a public person to make that difference. I mean, if you take the step and tell your coworkers, hey, I've been struggling with some stuff and I've decided I'm going to go to therapy. One, that means that you're going to have one of the most important things you can have in that process, which is a supportive social network.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's important for you, but it's also important for other people, because the more folks talk about this as what it is, which is just the same as physical health, health is health, the more people are going to feel comfortable, and it frankly saves lives.
You know, Diana, and I really appreciate those words, Jason, that very well said. You know, Diana, tell us about therapy. You know, a lot of people don't know what that is and what it might involve and might have some different kinds of ideas of what is entailed with therapy. Describe it to us. What is it?
Sure. So the first thing you need to know is that there's many, many different kinds of therapy.
Yes.
So what Jason went through in the VA was called prolonged exposure therapy, where they do deep dives into specific situations and they go over them and over them until they just become boring and they don't have as much sting to them. And what I did was somatic experience therapy, which is the theory that trauma gets trapped in your body. And it's a process to, no matter what the trauma was, to physically release the trauma from your nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
And there's EMDR therapy. I mean, there's so many different kinds of treatments just for PTSD. And one of the most important things is a lot of people think that they've tried something and it didn't work, so nothing will work for them. And I had previously tried to go see a therapist for my anxiety, and it wasn't fixing the situation. So when we first talked about going back to therapists, I was like, oh, I already did this. It didn't help me. And it was through Jason's encouragement that I went to go see somebody new.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend recommended this therapist, and she does this somatic work. And I was like, you know what? I really need talk therapy. I just need to talk through these issues. Mm-hmm. And she was like, well, why don't you just come in and try it? And, you know, you think you can solve this with your brain, but your brain just a small part of the puzzle. You know, it's not going to get fixed up there, because if it was, you would have fixed it mm-hmm. already. And my first time at doing this therapy, I walked out and I was on what I call like a peaceful high for 2.5 days. For 2.5 days, I felt like I had just been meditating for hours and hours. And that was such an incredible feeling. And it's been so, so good for me.
Yeah. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Jason and Diana Kander are here in the house. Tweet us at KCUR up to date. So I'm sort of wondering what now, Diana, and I'm also wondering, before we move on, about True, your son. He's now 6.
About to be, yeah. He would tell you it's very soon.
It's very soon.
19 days away.
He's counting down the
for
days.
Sure.
You had to navigate him throughout all this. I'm just wondering, how did that work? How did you do that?
You know, I can remember a conversation where you know, I told them, you know, Daddy's not going to be mayor. And he's a really sweet kid. So, and I told him, that, you know, I want to be with you more. And, you know, as he gets older, you know, he'll have access to Google. So before he does that, we will explain the rest of the story. But you know, right now it's Daddy decided to focus on being a daddy and being home more. And I remember when I told him I wasn't going to be mayor, he's a sweet kid. He said, well, but it's really important that you help people. And I said, yeah. And he said, but if you're not mayor, how are you going to help people? And then he told me, he said, Daddy, and this was based on a lesson I guess we had taught him. He said, you want to be with me and play with me. He said, but you need to help people. So I had to promise him that, you know, I was still going to help people. And now, I see him, I'm there every day. I'm a constant presence. And he loves Veterans Community Project, the work I'm doing now. You know, he often goes down there with me and hangs out. He totally gets it. Like, he didn't, you know, he's almost six. He was like, okay, mayor, and before that, president. He doesn't really understand what that is. But, you know, a few weeks ago, we were at an intersection, and we passed by, we were sitting at the intersection, and right next to us was a guy flying a sign, homeless gentleman. And I was just thinking about something else, eyes straight ahead. And True brought it to my attention and said, Daddy, you know, do we have any money in the car? And he reminded me, so I gave the guy a dollar. And as we're driving away, I was telling him, Buddy, I'm really proud of you. I was not thinking about that, and you said, you know, we need to help him. And he said, Daddy, he had on an army jacket, and I think maybe he's an army man, and he's cold at night. He doesn't have a house. He said, that's what you do. You help those people. And
so he's connecting it all.
Totally gets it, and he's really proud of me. And I hope that as he gets older and we tell him the rest of the story, that it's just another lesson for him about, you know, when you're going through something, you know, deal with it. Talk with people about it. There's nothing weak about it. It's only strong to do so.
Diane, what was your first impulse, though, to shield him from the struggles you two were up against? And how did you navigate that?
I mean, you know, around the time of the announcement, there's a lot of crying. We were like, you go watch TV. We're just going to cry in this room for a little bit. But my main concern, because of the things that I'd read about secondary PTSD, was transferring it to children, which often happens from people who have PTSD. And so Jason and I have just made a very conscientious effort to not put our hypervigilance onto him. So many times where we feel like, don't do that, you might die, we'll be like, hey, what if we didn't do that? That seems like it would be more fun to do something else. You know, just try to not, you know, create that drip campaign on him in the same way that we both experienced it.
To give you an idea, an example, we were just talking about this the other day. We just came back from vacation in California, and we were thinking about how about a year and a half ago, we were in Maine. I was giving a speech, and the whole family went, and there was a lighthouse that was about three stories up. It was about the least dangerous, in retrospect, least dangerous attraction you could possibly imagine. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely, like, I got very upset, and I would not allow Diana and True.
True wanted to go to the top of the lighthouse.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, it's too, and there's like, you know, it's a tourist attraction.
Right.
Indoor. It's an indoor set of stairs.
And I'm like, no, absolutely not. And you know, then you fast forward to several months of therapy for post-traumatic stress. And we just came back from California where True and Diana ziplined, and I was on the ground and I took a video of it. So like.
And we did several hikes onto cliffs.
Yeah, and
I mean, that's very different.
I was good with nearly all of it, and there was.
But we did it. We did it.
Got to a point where it was a little much for me.
And you can sit with your back to the door at a restaurant now.
Yeah,
I've seen it. Yeah.
For a decent amount of time. I can't do it indefinitely yet. I'm working on that, but.
Let's go to some phone calls for Jason and Diana Kander. 816-235-2888 is the phone number, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Katrina from Waldo. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, thanks for the topic. Thanks for bringing this up. My question is about a medical procedure for PTSD. I have PTSD. I am a civilian. I am not a veteran. But this is it's called SGB, stellate ganglion block. And I'm wondering if you are familiar with it or if you have done it. I'm getting ready to have this procedure done myself in a couple of weeks. It has a very high success rate, but it's almost done exclusively at VA hospitals. Do you know anything about it?
Yeah, Diana's nodding her head. Yes, Katrina. Yeah.
I've read about it. Jason hasn't had the procedure, but we have been hearing and reading about all kinds. And we're just on the theory that you should just keep trying things until you find something that works for you, because there will be something that does.
Yeah, I'm really careful to. What I worry about, because with me, I went through this period of like, I didn't earn this, and then B, why do I have this and other people didn't? And so, having that experience, whenever I talk about, you know, the treatment that we got, I try really hard to make sure that nobody takes it as, well, this worked for us, so therefore this should work for you. Like, mm-hmm. if what we had done hadn't worked, we would have gone on to trying the next thing. And so, no, I haven't done that, but that's only because something else worked for me, which is in no way a statement on the merits of that treatment that I did versus another, or about the severity of my own post-traumatic stress or anything else. It's just, you know, different treatments work for different people.
Yeah. Katrina, thank you for the call, and good luck to you.
Yeah, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Roxana tweeted this: thanks for removing the stigma of PTSD. How can we help the thousands of veterans who cannot get help from the VA and have been abandoned by the military, and the families who have had to pursue help privately?
Great question.
Yes.
Let me provide a little bit of context, because some people may not know exactly what she means, but I do, which is that about 80% of veterans don't actually ever end up going to the VA. And unfortunately, a large chunk of those people don't go because they're actually not eligible. Most folks assume, understandably, that somebody who served in uniform is a veteran. And they're right, by the way. But the federal government doesn't necessarily look at it that way. There's all sorts of different eligibility standards. In my own case, you know, when I first went into the VA, they said, well, actually, the rule is that if you've come in within the first 5 years of your combat deployment, then you're coming in, you're going to get treatment, no questions asked. But if it's after 5 years, we got an awful lot of verification work to do and that kind of thing, which when you think about it is frankly pretty dumb. Mm-hmm. Because trauma doesn't get better with age. It ain't wine. You know, it actually gets a lot worse. And so that's just one example. But on top of that, there are a lot of people with what's called bad paper discharges, you know, mm-hmm. discharges that are other than honorable. And oftentimes, you know, there's folks, for instance, who maybe they got a dishonorable discharge because they had 3 DUIs. Well, you poke a little bit further and you find out they got 3 DUIs in between their 4 combat deployments. Mm-hmm. It ain't that hard to figure out that they were dealing with post-traumatic stress and they were self-medicating. And that's just one example. There's a lot of different ways that this happens. It's one of the reasons I'm so proud to work with Veterans Community Project.
Tell us what that is.
So Veterans Community Project, it's based here in Kansas City. It started here. My role is to expand it nationally, and that's what I'm doing. But it basically, we exist to fill in the gaps in veteran services. And part of that is providing walk-in services to any veteran. Here in Kansas City, we've served over 4,000, including myself, by the way. That's how I got involved with the organization in the first place.
Right.
And that can be anything. It can be connecting people to community services like, you know, mental health services, you name it. But it also can be making sure people get the services that they should receive from the VA. But then the other part of it is transitional housing, filling in the gaps in housing. The federal housing assistance for veterans, it's for permanent supportive housing. It doesn't include people who just, they need a transition. They need to come right off the street and be prepared for independent living. And so Veterans Community Project has a veterans village at 89th and Truce that by November will be 49 completed tiny houses. And it's playing a large role in effectively eliminating veterans homelessness in Kansas City, and it can do it around the country. But to get back to her question, one of the things we do that's so important is we don't, if you raised your hand and swore an oath to defend the country, if you wrote that blank check to include your life, we don't have any other questions about whether, you know, you served in this place at this time, what kind of discharge you had. We just say yes first. Mm-hmm. And honestly, that's how the system ought to work. And so the answer to the question, what can you do? Well, one thing you can do is you can go to veteranscommunityproject.org and you can lend your support. You can lend your literal support right here in the community. For those who are, you know, have connections around the country or listening to this to other places in the country, we're ready to expand nationally. So
I was going to say, where does your funding come from? Because housing is not cheap.
It's all private donations. Because we accept every kind of veteran, we therefore can't go get the housing vouchers that are provided by the federal government because they're just for VA-eligible veterans. Mm-hmm. So it's corporate donations, it's individual donations, it's foundations. So at this moment, it's all private fundraising.
You know, Diana, and again, we're visiting with Jason and Diana Kander this morning here on Up to Date. I mentioned in the opening that you have a new book out, The Curiosity Muscle. You co-wrote it with Andy Fromm. Tell us about that. I mean, clearly you're moving ahead too.
Sure. Well, it's got a very simple premise that if you want better results in whatever it is that you're doing, you just have to learn how to ask better questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's true for all parts of life. And there are specific questions that most people never ask about their business and what they're working on, including what are your blind spots? What is it that you don't know? People just assume, become overconfident in their customers and what they're working on and don't ask, you know, what am I missing? Mm-hmm. Or what can I try? How can I improve what's already good? Yeah, including, you know, PTSD. We had some big blind spots in our
lives. Are you back
lives.
Speaking publicly?
Yeah, I've been doing it. It's been the busiest year I've ever had speaking.
Yeah.
So.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. Larry from Lawrence. Larry, you're on Up to Date with Jason and Diana Kander. Good morning.
Good morning to all of you. My dad was a veteran of World War II, and even though I never have suffered from the malady that y'all are speaking of, I did want to say that every year on PBS, I watch the Memorial Day concert that honors veterans. And I'm very emotional about this, as you can probably tell. I think that one of the speakers said that it shouldn't be called PTSD. It should just be called PTS, because it's not a disorder. It's a perfectly natural thing that happens to men and women who've suffered in combat.
Yeah. First of all,
interesting point.
Yeah, yeah. Larry, thank you. I agree. I try, sometimes I get out of the habit, but I try to just refer to it as PTS or post-traumatic stress. And it's an injury. I mean, that's how I describe it to people. You know, you go through something and you get hurt. But what that means is that like any other injury, it's not something you cure, but it's something you can treat and you can recover. And that's what we have done. That's what post-traumatic growth is. I mean, and that's why it's so important for anybody who's gone through something and is thinking maybe they need to get help, that they go ahead and treat that injury. I mean, I went almost 12 years without treating the injury, and that's why it just got worse and worse and worse. And if you think of that compared to any other injury, if you broke your arm and then you said, you know, I should just suck it up, this is going to get better, then over a period of time, your arm would be more and more mangled, and eventually it would take a lot more mm-hmm. to repair that injury. And so post-traumatic stress is an injury, and it should be thought of like any other kind of injury.
You know, I can't help but notice that a couple of presidential candidates have already swung by to visit the Veterans Community Project, and you've escorted them around, Jason. When you look at the field, the Democratic field for president, and you realize that maybe in a different set of circumstances, you could have been among those candidates, what goes through your mind? You feel you're missing out, or are you watching it with extra closeness? What do you think?
I'm going to punt to Diana in a second, because she has, she's a little better at talking. Like, I think I'm not that objective. And that's because, well, to answer your question, there are moments where, of course, I look at it and, like, you know, we watched about a quarter of the debate so far, and there's certainly moments where I'm like, well, here's what I would have said.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously. But then the other thing is, you know, as you know, Steve, I basically ran for president for a year and a half. I mean, I went to 46 states in a year and a half. I actually did Iowa and New Hampshire like 12 yes. times each.
We noticed.
Yes, yeah. You did. And you wrote a very nice piece about it, which mm-hmm. I appreciate. So I was talking to a friend of mine who also everybody thought was going to run and didn't. And one of the things we talked about was how nice it is to know exactly what it's like, and to watch it and not feel like, oh, there's no part of me that watches any of that and is like, oh, that would be amazing, because I know exactly what it feels like. So I don't have a fear of missing out at all. And to give you an example, you know, Mayor Pete is one of the folks who has visited VCP,
right.
and I'm friends with almost everybody running, and so I feel like I know them all pretty well, and mm-hmm. and so I was hanging out with Pete. We both were, and then the visit ended, and you know he went to go get in the black SUV with staff and drive off, and that used to be me, and I was staying at VCP Veterans Community Project to go back in with our staff and hang out and have lunch and commiserate about what just happened. And I remember being really struck by the fact that I was really happy not to get in that SUV. Mm. I'm really, really happy about what I'm doing now. I feel really good about it.
So, do you have a future in politics? Have you ruled it out? Where are you?
You know, I used to answer questions from the likes of you and others with dodges like, you know, I'm not really thinking about that right now. I rarely meant that, honestly.
Really?
Yeah, I know you're shocked. Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that how that works?
I'm glad you're sitting down.
Yeah.
but I actually really mean it now. And that's the thing is, when you're going through a bunch of turmoil internally, it makes a lot of sense in a way to think about what you'll do in the future, because that's a much more pleasant thought than what you're going through right now. So I was often thinking about, well, I'll do this and I'll do this, or maybe I could do this. I don't think about that hardly at all anymore. So the answer to your question is, I don't know. I have no idea. I don't have any part of me that wants to run for office right now. I'm open to the idea that that could change. It doesn't mean I'm going to be out of politics. Like, I have a platform. I haven't changed my beliefs about what's going on in the country.
Right.
I'm not suddenly satisfied with it. So, you know, as people have probably seen over the last few weeks, from time to time, I'm going to speak out and say something. And next year, when my party has a nominee, I expect I'll probably get out there and do some surrogate work and try and do my part to get people out there knocking doors and that kind of thing.
Are you going to endorse in the meantime?
I don't plan on it. A lot of my friends are running for president, and they're real friends.
Yeah.
And I like them, and I think that the field is strong, and I'm really grateful that so many of them are interested in Veterans Community Project.
I got 20 seconds left, Diana. Can a candidate for president or the U.S. Senate run with a background of PTS, in your view?
I think it makes them more human. Everybody's struggling with something, and the more vulnerable somebody can be about what they're struggling with makes them more authentic. And I think an authentic president would be a sharp difference from what we have now.
Hmm. Jason and Diana Kander, thank you so much for your comments.
Thank you, Steve.
What you're saying and doing, and really appreciate you spending an hour with us today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Wishing you both the best. You bet. Monday on the show, the smart money experts will share strategies for finding and financing housing options to suit your retirement plans. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Elizabeth Ruiz. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.